August 14, 2021. So a lot for Pedro Show.
Oh, Happy with a khaki sweatband, old bowed, pot-bellied barnyard that only he noticed. The old fart was smart. These words were my calling card, used as defense against squares throughout northern New Jersey in the early years of the 1970s. Incanted while playing pinball, they sometimes piqued the interest of teenaged hipster chicks, lollygagging around the bowling alley. Spoken in the classroom, or the dining hall, or locker room, they were more a way of creating a bubble of madness to protect me from the goddamn normals who dogged my every sullen step, trying to impress me with words and gestures I could not understand. But the poetry of Captain Beefheart, at first even more than his music, got under my skin and laid eggs that have continuously erupted. I would never be fool enough to say I enjoyed all the Captain's bands or records or tours, but most of them were fine beyond belief, providing a glimpse of something so weird yet apparently sustainable that it was a balm to my soul and also to the souls of the many other losers who I would come to enjoy and respect over the next decades of my life. Years that would have been far bleaker, perhaps even devoid of splendor without the model he provided. So let this stand as a toast to the ghost most holio, imperfectly human yet unblemished, as a saint to the disaffected youth who found sense and succor in his vision of things as they might be and perhaps even as they truly were. You know what I mean? Good night, Don. Good night.
Watch from Pedro Show. Happy Saturday. I'm playing Pedro a little later today with Pizzo and Jerzo, second man. Saturday. Started off the show, John Coltrane, live in Seattle, 1965, Evolution. Donald Garrett, I think, sometimes bass clarinet, sometimes the other, like there's two basses, so I can't remember exactly what he's doing here. But incredible record. Rumor is, yeah, Mr. Coltrane was on L, but there's other stories about him reviewing the gig and stuff and while it was underway and somebody tripping balls unless it was very together that way. After that, Beefheart from Byron Coley. Brother Matt, Love Grotto. Soon we're going to be reunited, though. But I'm not totally man alone because of those Estonian software engineers with their Skype invention. I got Mr. Byron Coley. Welcome aboard, Brother Byron. And are you reaching out?
Yeah, Western Mass. Western Mass.
Okay.
In my TV room.
Okay, TV room. That's better than the name of the town. What's Jay? Amherst? Yeah.
Yeah, Jay's in Amherst. But, you know, it's all like Western Mass. It's one of those areas, like the towns in a kind of way don't really matter. We're in this river valley here.
Right.
And everything that's in the river valley kind of flows together.
In fact, there's a bunch of colleges there, right?
There are a bunch of colleges there, which is what, the reason I came out to this area, my first time I ever did. And then, good.
Talking about the Wayback Machine, let's fucking venture into it. Please bring your earliest musical recollection.
My earliest musical recollection was, you're talking about listening to the radio or seeing a band or what?
Any kind of musical recollection. Remember, it's the Watford Pedro Show. There's no hard questions. There's no wrong answers.
Well, I mean, the thing is, the first album I ever bought was Hey Little Cobra, another Hot Rod Hits by the Ripcords.
Now, that's just with your own money, though, right?
Yeah, with my own money. You know, my parents had bought me, like, you know.
No, but I always ask the question on the show for the last 20 years. What's the first record you bought with your own money? Because when you're a kid, you ain't got a lot of money.
So no, I bought that with my own money. I'd gotten, I'd saved up. You know, you get, like, little bits and pieces. This is really before allowance kicked in. I mean, this is, like, early 64. So, like, pre-Beatles. And, you know, I had a babysitter who was really into this record. And Hey Little Cobra, and I was like, oh man, this is a great record. I was maybe it's like third grade, I think.
So you don't have any musical memories before buying your first record?
Well,
like I have some dudes on the show, they can remember being in their mom's womb while they're driving around in the car.
You know, the thing is, my parents were not music people at all. Like my dad, like they had one of those hi-fi stereos, like, you know, the old console, big
Muntz?
Kind of mahogany thing. Yeah, it was like Marantz or something like that. And they would, like, their big thing was playing, like, crappy. Like, he had an album of a cover version of the soundtrack for On the Beach. You know, the Neville Shute thing about the, like, when the atomic bomb goes off. And the first, so I can really remember, like, lying in there in the room, like, waiting to hear the part where the atomic bomb goes off. Like, my dad would go, like, that's the part where the atomic bomb goes off. And I'd be like, oh, it's so cool.
There's records like that. I remember, like, General MacArthur's retire or farewell, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Yeah, these were like records. Who the fuck would buy some shit like that?
You know, the first time I went to visit John Fahey in Salem, Oregon, in his motel room, when I walked into the room, he was playing that MacArthur record.
Okay. Yeah.
Although he was playing it on tape. He had to tape the thing. And he was playing it really, really loud.
My mom told me that was a huge fucking hit.
Yeah, you know, I mean, for a certain generation, that was like,
it was dirt early, but she didn't like him. Let me ask you this, first gig you went and saw?
It's Us opening for the Left Bank. At the Kinnelon,
Don't Walk Away,
yeah, Kinnelon
Renee.
High School. What's that?
Don't Walk Away, Renee.
Walk Away, Renee, Pretty Ballerina.
I think they called that Baroque rock.
They did. I didn't really know what to call it. But it was like, I was going because a friend of mine's brother's band was opening. But, I mean, I wanted to go. Oh, I would have gone anyway. It was where I lived, there were not many shows, especially that you could go to if you were, like, not, you know, we were a little kid.
Yeah.
So it's just like, you know, I think it was probably spring of 67 or
what town?
Late 66. Kinnelon, New Jersey.
Okay. Like, it's like a little California turned the other way when I look at the license plate.
Yeah.
You gave me this thing,
Orchid Spangiophora. Yeah.
Yeah. Trapped hair suite.
Yeah.
And not just any part, but part two.
Well.
Don't listen to her for that.
Hello?
On. Alpha Princess goes on. Alpha Princess goes
Marvin Welch and Farrar. It's good stuff.
His big one was Apache. Watt for Pedro Show, that chunk of music started off with Orchid Spangia Flora, Part 2, The Trapped Hair Suite. Then we had Part B1 of the Bronze Age UFO, Lagoon Monster Rubber Mask Volume 2 from Balmore, the most recent release. Bombas Prendon. You know about Bombas Prendon?
Sure. They asked me to write the liner notes for that one.
Okay. Well, this is brand new. No, they just gave me
a new
archive.
I know. It's reissue stuff. It's great. They were great.
This is shit out of archive that they got some guy, got a radio show that in that D.C. area. He went through all the, like they got 6,000 songs or something, right?
Oh, no, they got a ton. I mean, the thing is that it's a weird, that whole E-Cleft scene. That's like Richmond, Virginia guys.
Right. VCU.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
that's weird. They were together
40 years and maybe did 5 gigs, but recorded like motherfuckers.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, I reviewed some of that stuff back in the New York rocker days.
Andy Schwartz.
Yeah.
Good old Andy Schwartz.
Yeah.
And then, that was the Nostrils of Everest. And then finally, something you gave me: Magnificent Pudlians with Norwegian Wood Klingon. And a little Jonathan Swift reference there, and mixed in with some fucking, you know what they found orbiting Uranus? Klingons. And you know what they found in the captain's head?
No.
The captain's log.
Oh, beautiful.
I'm gonna.
Jesus.
So look.
Yeah.
You didn't really get into the garage band thing, but you ended up writing about music. When did you first write about music?
I started writing about music in like 5th grade. My parents gave me a typewriter for Christmas in like 65 or so. And so I would type up like a little one-sheet thing every couple of weeks and pass it around to my classmates then. And it sort of went from there.
Yeah, but what was the one-sheet? Record reviews?
Well, I wouldn't do really record reviews because I didn't have very many records.
But what was on the one-sheet? What was on the fucking one-sheet?
I would go through like local newspapers and stuff and find out like what bands were playing in different places and just sort of type up about that. The Orbitrons are playing at the Baggy Knees.
Yeah,
in
so you're giving your classmates previews of what's coming up, shows they should see, gigs they should fucking
see. Although none of us could go out and see anything.
Yeah, right.
I couldn't really figure. I thought it was interesting to do. It was incredibly stupid, but you know, whatever.
Well, you know that gig you told me you went and saw. How'd that happen?
What's that? They were just playing.
The band was opening up, right? So
it was the local high school was, you know, doing a show, and you know, in my town, if that meant it was an all ages thing.
Okay, I understand.
So you could just go. I mean,
Did that gig make the one sheet?
That was probably after I was at a new school by then, so that was past my one sheet days.
You gave it up.
I did. I was trying to write for the school paper after that, but they would never really let me.
I got to write some reviews my senior at Peter I here. It was called The Four.
Really?
I wouldn't shit you, Byron.
What did you review?
Frampton Comes Alive and, maybe a Kiss record. It was the 1976.
Comes Alive.
Last year of high school. The paper, of course, is called The Fore and Aft.
It's when Frampton Comes Alive came out, I was working for UPS. I was a pre-sort loader, and I had to work, like, loading trucks. I was a Teamster. It was, like, 4 to 8 every morning I worked.
Whoa.
And these guys, the guys who did the pre-sorting stuff would play that fucking record, like, really loud, like, through the whole warehouse all the time. It would drive me crazy.
Well, you can blame Steve Marriott because he stole his humble pie from him. You know about that. We're at the end of the first hour. August 14, 2021, this Watt Pedro Show special guest, Byron Coley. Hold tight for hour two. August 14, 2021, it's second hour of Watt for Pedro Show.
I'm going to think about this every day. I'm going to fly on my own Bacon Street.
You're going to have to understand.
portrait is letting loose. After my mindset.
After hours. Did you become so used to it that you couldn't get far away?
This from departure is purely decomposed. Another way.
Woo! Thank you. beginning this week. Everything will begin with S. Dirt will begin with S. Radishes will begin with S. Destiny, prosthetics, and flotation will all begin with S. Big Walnut Yonder will begin with S. Days Darker Than Your Nights will begin with S. High as a Kite, Bold as a Beat will begin with S. Walled City Fresh Pecs will begin with S. Come, Go, Cease, Desist, Tumid Bodies Implode will begin with S. The Fatal Jack-Off on the Moon will begin with S. Pop, 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 Bebop will begin with S. In a God of the Vita will begin with S. The 19th through 23rd Featherweight Champs will begin with S. Westward Ho, the Beeswax will begin with S. Shit will still begin with S.
Dog kept staring at me, so I went through my pockets again. While I was doing it, I realized the guys strapped over the mailbox were kind of familiar. So I asked him, "Hey, do I know you?" He said, "Well, indeed you might. My name is Robert Krisko. I'm the Dean of American Rock Critics, and I ask you as a fellow human to free me from my canine bondage." My initial reaction was to go for my knife in my pocket, cut the guy loose. Then I realized that Krisko was the man who had brought a grade lettering to records, allowing me to peruse a little bit of his career in my mind. I realized this was the dipshit who thought that Wings, Venus, and Mars was superior to the Syd Barrett solo albums, that both Marlo Thomas and Bette Midler had made LPs superior to Beefheart's Clear Spot, that Big Star Third was the equivalent of Elton John's Honky Chateau, though not as good as Springsteen's Born to Run. Consequently, I decided to give him to the dog. I took the butter pass out of my pocket, handed him to the pooch, and off I went.
We start out the second hour with Toothless Grin and After Our Mindset. Lucas Bell after that asked Sydney with Ooh, Ooh, Oh, the parentheses, so that's in Spanish. Plaster Men out of Ithaca, the New York upstate one. This new one, Spiel Gusher, begins with S. Which, thank you for the vinyl version, you and Brother Ted.
Yeah.
Bark at Bob's Back Door, Byron Coley. So look, you're trying to write reviews for the school paper.
Yeah.
By that time, had you written? I want you to tell me everything you know about Richard Meltzer.
I know. You know, I mean, the thing is, Meltzer was a. You know, I started reading him when he was writing for Crawdaddy.
Yeah.
I didn't really. I didn't have any contact with him until quite a few years later, though.
I can imagine that.
You know, I think like when he was still in New York, I had some contact with him, like in the later part of the 70s. But I didn't start hanging out with him until like the Vom era.
Detroit Street.
Yeah.
Right? By Pink's.
Yeah.
Hollywood.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, I would write him and stuff, and he was like, there were only a couple guys, like when I was sort of starting as like a professional rock critic type thing back in the 70s, most people who were older and established were really like hard to deal with, but Meltzer and this guy, Mick Farren, this English guy, were both like super friendly and nice and all that stuff. And so I just sort of would get in touch with them, and I sort of kept in touch with both those guys for a very long time. And then, you know, Meltzer's just like, I don't know. I mean, I think I still think he's one of the greatest, most underappreciated, like most influential writers that's ever.
Not underappreciated by what? I'll tell you that. I love
no,
that man.
But you know,
I understand what you're trying to say. Yeah.
He just doesn't, I mean, I feel like his influence got picked up by a lot of people who never acknowledged him at
all.
Who became very popular. I mean, the thing is, when I really started writing, my stuff was, at a certain point, it was like pure, like, fake Meltzer. And it was like, you know, like people say you should start like, you know, you start off writing copying some person you like. You know, people start with a Hemingway or they, you know, whatever.
Blue Oyster Cult or Creedence Clearwater Revival.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, a band does the same thing. You have to learn some of the, like, rhythms before you can start developing your own.
Okay.
And for me, that was like Meltzer, like, so, like, clearly. And
can you remember the first time you met him in person?
The first time he really, I mean, I met him a few times in, like, things with, like, a bunch of different people there in New York. But the first time I ever really went up to him was like at a VOM gig in San Francisco at the Mabuhay. And, you know, like sort of like, you know, I think it was maybe early 78. And, you know, he sort of knew who I was because I'd written him a bunch and stuff like that. And we started talking about different stuff and, you know, he was like a super funny guy. At that point, VOM was doing this thing where they'd be throwing out like all these t-shirts, like promotional t-shirts that they'd fucked around with.
Oh, fuck, they would throw live cockroaches at the whiskey.
Well, yeah, they did. I mean, they did the whole cockroach thing. Well, you know, that was because of Turner.
Greg Turner.
Greg Turner's dad was the science supervisor for like maybe Ventura County or something. So Greg could get, like, a permission to go, like, a card to go to this bug emporium in Compton and buy, like, you know, Bronco worms or whatever. I mean, have you talked to Raymond about that show at Kahuna's Bearded Clam?
Yeah.
I mean, that's why Greg would never let the Angry Samoans play with Black Flag because he hated that show so much.
Yeah.
When they threw the crickets out, you know, he was like, I would talk to him all the time when I was working at SSD. And he'd be like, I can't. Those guys suck. And it was the cricket thing.
I can imagine. You know the way human beings are. Well, I'm a big VOM fan. I should let the people, Richard Meltzer had a band called VOM with Greg Turner people. So tell me about that first meet. So he knows who you are. And what do you guys talk about? This is at the MAB.
Well, you know, we were both, like, kind of drunk. And so I think we ended up talking about Claude Bessie mostly.
Kick Boy Face.
Yes. Because I was really curious because I'd been down in L.A. a bunch, and I couldn't figure out Claude at all.
No, but I'll tell you this. He was so kind. He would give you no problem talking to you anytime. I got to say that about those days, all those people. That you could be and they would just rap with you. Wasn't that the coolest fucking thing?
It's true, although the first time I met Claude was under really kind of like bad circumstances. I was at the Whiskey with this friend of mine's band from Minnesota, the Suicide Commandos.
Oh, yeah.
And so Claude was going to interview them. And I was really pretty drunk. And I kept on like barging in this interview. And Claude was really kind of pissed off. Well, and I was like, so I started sort of making fun of his accent and stuff.
Yeah, that's a good
one. It was
move.
Really like, it was just like, I mean, it was a really bonehead move, but it was like, he got really pissed off. And so when he would see me after that, then at stuff, he would sort of like give me like a really, he would be very, unhappy to see me. Anyway,
did he know you were a writer like Richard did?
No. Okay. No. He just thought I was, you know, I was like some bozo.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which, I mean,
he
I not
saw you as
not
a rival.
Some
now,
bozo.
Now, Richard never saw you as a rival. Now, did Richard ever talk about similarity in his style and your style? Or did you ever, like, talk to him about that or apologize?
I talked to him about it, and he said, like, you know, he said he would have never he would never confuse us. That's right. And I was like, you know, I say, because there were other people who were getting the same sort of rap, someone at that time, although I got it worse than most people. Like, there was a guy who bought New York Rocker when Andy decided to close it.
Yeah.
This guy bought it, and then this fellow named John Morthland, who was a longtime critic, took over the review section. And I had been one of the main writers for New York Rocker. And so I got in touch with him and go like, oh, man, what can I do something? So I was like, you're nothing more than a Meltzer imitator.
Jesus.
Like, okay, you know. I mean, I think you're wrong, but whatever, man. It's like,
Well, did he scissor you?
Oh, yeah. I never got a chance to write for him after that. You know, people have... The thing is, people really didn't like Meltzer in a certain way. Because he was just like, he was so loose. And he wouldn't do what anybody wanted him to do. You know, if you read some of his things like...
A Whore like the Rest, right?
Yeah. I mean, they're just like, he kind of pisses on all those guys.
Oh, yeah. Big.
Like, what they're doing. He just does that. He just doesn't... He won't toe the line, and he doesn't really like... You know, the thing is, there was a point, I think, where he was so bored with what rock music had become.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, if you remember the, like, you know, the Hep Cats from Hell show.
I loved it.
I mean, KPFK. Yeah, but he really thought punk wasn't rock music, you know? He thought it was like a new type of music.
Yeah.
And he just really didn't think they were connected. And he was
I think it was wishful thinking. He didn't want them to.
No, it was wishful thinking.
Yeah. Same with me. Because it was a reaction, well, maybe not rock music, but arena rock for sure.
Yeah.
Maybe not Little Richard stuff. I think he liked Little Richard, Jerry Lee Lewis, but arena rock.
That's true. The thing is, that's rock and roll to him.
Yeah, right.
He always made a big distinction between rock and roll and rock. I mean, the whole aesthetic of rock.
Arena rock.
It's about the dropping of roll, and then you get to this rock music. Like, what is that?
Yeah,
it's like
and then, of course, if you got that, then you have the Dean of Rock.
Yeah, right.
Which was,
you know, Chris.
Yeah, the piece I played right before our spiel here.
I know. I mean, Chris Gow, you know, like, I wrote for The Voice, but Chris Gow would never let me write for The Voice after that, like, that Sonic Youth single that we did at Forced
killed
Exposure.
Big dick, big fucking dick, right?
Yeah. I killed Prisco with my big fucking dick. and it was like, it was kind of a drag in a way because I didn't tell the band we were going to call it that. it was just like when I got it, I was like, Chris Gayle had been ignoring Sonic Youth as a band. Yeah, yeah. Like, really ignoring them. And I thought it was, like, kind of jive. And so I was like, oh, well, you know.
You know what? I'm going to get into this issue. Not particular about this, but what I've noticed nowadays compared to those days. But first I want to – something you and Thirst did called Dapper.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do it.
Okay.
She just be guitar now.
Thank you.
I'm from Pedro Show. That chunk of music started and ended with Dapper. First of and the bookend was Painted My Teeth. Then No Joy with Here Tarot Lies, If Bawana, Radial Slaves. That's Al Margolis out of Chester, New York, up the river. And then Dapper Live, War Sucks. Okay, what about the power of the record reviewer in those days with printed reviews compared to the power of the record reviewer nowadays?
Well, there was a period where, you know, people paid attention to record reviews because there were magazines, there were, you know, it was mostly magazines that people sort of trusted. Or there were fanzines or whatever. And I don't think that that's true anymore because it's all, you know, I mean, I write a lot of like one sheets for records. And now when I see reviews, most of them are just rewrites of the one sheet, you know, whoever put it out. It's like not, like nobody wants to have their own opinion anymore, you know? Nobody wants to be the guy who says like, oh, no, Nirvana blow. It's just like, and then be like, oh my God, I like said Nirvana were no good. You know, it's like, people just want to ratify other people's opinions now. Back in the day, people would like, well, the people who were interesting and the people who I liked their stuff and the people who anybody paid attention to were writing about things that either, that they were just saying what they thought about these records. And it made sense or it didn't. And people could judge a writer by how consistent they were in their thing. They might disagree with the person. And then so the guy would give it a bad review and he'd go like, oh, the reason that guy gave it a bad review means I probably really like it. You know, it doesn't – there's not that anymore at all anywhere.
Well, Richard told me he got disillusioned kind of early on because he thought he was in the trenches with the band. And then, you're shieldom for the label.
Yeah.
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 So, well, do you think any band's careers were ever hurt by bad reviews?
I'm sure that there were. I think that bands that really got dismissed who weren't very well known, it had to fuck up their bookings. I mean, it really had to. The thing is, I mean, if you ask for an example, I'm not sure I can give one except maybe like Sir Lord Baltimore. Who I thought were a pretty good band, but never, I mean, I saw them play at Greenwood Lake around 72 or so, and I thought, you know, like a singing drummer thing. It was like, yeah, cool, you know? It was like, but they never got a good review anywhere, and...
Rare Earth. The only Rare Earth? Band for Motown. Yeah, they had the singing drummer thing.
Yeah. Rare Earth, not really one of my favorite bands, although I like the way that they packaged that album, so it looked like kind of like an army duffel bag.
So, I mean, but anyway, I got you on the tangent. We were talking about record reviews ruining bands. I asked that because it seems like the bands that sold a buttload of records, a lot of them got negative reviews.
Well, you know, I mean, the classic, of course, is Led Zeppelin, you know, who John Mendelsohn, like, panned, you know, in Rolling Stone, the first one. I mean, like, he thought Grand Funk were better.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look at the Stooges. I mean, Jesus.
I mean,
talk about some revisionism on some record reviews. Oh my God!
It's true. No, it's true. I mean, the number of people who liked the Stooges early on, you know, it's like, you know, Meltzer's review of the Ungano Show is like a classic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I mean, the thing is, though, Lester Bangs, his like review of the second record was like, you know, he sort of revived himself. But you know, I mean, the thing is, like, the Stooges were hard. So hard to figure out, and they didn't, that original band didn't really tour that much. So the thing is, if you're just listening to the record, I mean, that record was, when I was first in college, like in, like 74, that record, the first album was cut out and available in the bookstore. And I get it for 99 cents, like as many copies as I wanted. And so I would regularly buy it for people as a birthday present. And I would give it to them, and people would say like, is this like a joke? I mean, like every song sounds the same. I'd say like, well, you know, We Will Fall sounds quite a bit different. You know, they're going, no, it's like every song's the same. I'd be like, well,
But I did think Funhouse, loose, TVI, and Down on the Street. Me and D. Boone thought it was the same song played three different ways.
Well,
but we really liked it. That wasn't a bad thing.
The thing is, though,
that
wasn't
a bad thing.
No, I mean, I would have agreed to a certain extent that a lot of the songs on those albums sounded similar. But, the lyrics were great. The riffs were great. What's the problem?
Well, because I think there was a lot of peer pressure in those days, and that's one of the points I'm trying to get at. Do you think that record reviews kind of reinforce this shit, the group think, on the verdict of a certain...
Oh, they definitely did, because...
But the marketplace, Styx, there's bands that got terrible reviews that sold buttloads.
Well, have you ever seen a live Styx show? off the charts, baby. they're fucking better than Kansas.
I bet.
I mean, and I don't say that. I don't say that with too many bands.
A lot of it,
I must say, is live shows. And the thing is, look, if you just want to smoke a joint and go to sleep at a show, what better than Styx in a big auditorium?
What I'm saying is maybe we're free of that fucking moral dilemma, because it doesn't seem that reviews carry that much weight.
Yeah, they kind of don't, it's good and it's bad. The thing is, there's so much stuff
that's exactly what I'm getting at. It's kind of good and it is what it is.
There's no getting past it. It's problematic, though, if you don't have at least a few writers who you can look at, you think they're at least consistent and I sort of get what they're going about. If you're, who's got the time to like download every Bandcamp thing, or listen to it? It's there's a million bands now. And the way that some people describe them, you'd think this is going to sound great. And you put it on and it really sounds this band should be called Pudge.
Do you think a part of a record review's toolbox, vocabulary, whatever, is the idea of genre to give a shortcut on the listeners or potential record?
It's very problematic.
Yeah.
It really is. But the thing is, it's very, depending on what sort of length of review you're doing, it's a good idea, I think, to do it if you really know what you're doing, because you at least give somebody an idea of what area it's going off into.
Or at least the way your mind is dealing with it.
It's true.
Right, because that's all what I've always got from your reviews. It's a personal experience. It's beautiful.
I talk
up on the next hour because we're out of time. We're at the end of the second hour, August 14, 2021. This Watt Peter's special guest, Byron Coley, Old Time for Hour 3. August 14, 2021. It's the third hour of the Watt from Pedro show.
There's a fire burning, and Mingus is on the box. And as so often happens, when Mingus is on the box, I am thinking of D. Boone. The music of Mingus and the soul of Mingus and the volume of air displaced by Mingus rarely fail to bring that other great American into my mind. The vision of Mingus on the eve of eviction, firing his shotgun into the ceiling of his loft with a grin of surprised delight, reminds me of a show at the T-Bird Roller Dome in Fullerton. The stage that night was a too-high pile of risers, stacked in a way that was none too stable. When the Superheroines played, you didn't really notice how wobbly it was. But when the Minutemen played, they'd move around quite a bit, and every time D. Boone shouted motherfucker into the mic, he'd jump into the air, and when he landed, those risers shook like crazy. D. Boone shouted motherfucker a lot, so the stage shook a lot. And every time it shook, D. Boone got the same little grin Mingus got when he emptied his shotgun into the air. And the music of Mingus, as the music of D. Boone, blasts through the dark reaches of the universal nothing, setting ablaze brains that have been so long seized by cold, they have become their own engines of nada. For the collective sake of whatever is left, let us hope the future of this world is never one in which the match that is Mingus and the match that is D. Boone have been lost to our brains and to our souls forever.
dimension, atmospheres, there's nothing like it. It's nothing like the Earth at all, man. It's much bigger than that. You get on my planet, man, you just don't know where you're at, man, you just don't know where you're at. You look around and you see these 100-mile-high buildings. Man, you just go kind of crazy. You just don't know where you're at, man. You just don't know where you're at. You're there, man. But at the same time, you ain't there. You're somewhere else. You just don't know where you're at, man. You just try to figure the whole thing out, man. You just can't make heads or tails out of nothing. Society? There's no society there to conform to, man. It's just a density in the hyperprism of the universe, man. No one can experience nothing like it. You're just like in the Twilight Zone, man. In the Twilight Zone. Like, man, you look around and you try to find yourself. You can't even find yourself, man. It seems like you just can't find nothing. Nothing to identify with you. You're just out there, man. Like, man, you're just out there. Like the density of the hyperprism, man. Deep. Big. Nothing like the Earth. spaceport is a heaven. In that, it is a haven. The music of the outer darkness is the music of the void. The opening is the void, but the opening is synonym to the beginning. This is an indication, interpretation. Some music is a specialized interpretation. Some music is of synchronization, precision. Every light is a vibrational sight and sound. It is rhythm and harmony with beams, rays of intensification and projection visibility. Music is light and darkness, precedent of vitality, stimulation extraordinary. Black is space. Well, sometimes. The outer darkness music, it becomes more than music. The void direction to the heavens. In this thought, it reaches an incredible plane. Each spaceport is a heaven, the potential of what can be. In that, it is a haven, done physically, without precedence. The music of the outer darkness is, except in the present designed action, the music of the void, of the eternal, endless universe. The opening is the void. Every action is rhythm. But the opening is synonym to the beginning in all its interrelated being. This is an indication, interpretation. I have said before that the music is the words. Some music is of specialized interpretation, and the words are music. Some music is of synchronization precision. It is all for you to understand if you can. Every light is a vibrational sight and sound, and for you to feel regardless. It is rhythm and harmony with beams. It is a feeling that is a sign of beingness. Rays of intensification and projection visibility, the simulated movement. Music is light and darkness is the key to oneness. Precedent of vitality of that which is on. Stimulation extraordinary, still it is the key. Black is space. Sometimes music becomes more than music. The outer darkness, and this thought reaches an incredible plane. Void direction to the heavens, the potential of what can be. Each spaceport is heaven, done psychically is without precedent. In that, it is a haven, except in the presence designed action. The music of the outer darkness of the eternal, endless universe is the music of the void. Every action is rhythm. The opening is the void, but the opening is synonym to the beginning. In all its interrelated being, this is an indication, interpretation. I have said before that the music is words, and the words are music. Some music is of specialized interpretation, is all there is for you to understand if you can. Some music is of synchronization, precision, and for you to feel regardless. Every light is vibrational sight and sound. It is a feeling that is a sign of beingness. It is a rhythm and harmony with beams, the stimulated movement, rays of intensification, and projection visibility is the key to oneness. Music is light and darkness of that which is on, precedent of vitality. Kill, it is the key that does not lock any door, stimulation extraordinary. There is no entrance. There is only the presence of being where the awareness dwells, where the coordinating action axis, the knowledge music is different from the wisdom music in the finer distinction of presence. Wisdom includes intuition as an ever-present companion, prescience in a sort of diagonal, symmetrical way. In a way, creation is a transitional form of intuition. Black is space, the outer darkness, the void direction into the heavens. Each spaceport is a heaven, that is, it is a haven. The music of the outer darkness is the inside music of the void. The opening is the void, but the opening is the synonym to the beginning. This is an indication, interpretation. Some music is of specialized interpretation. Some music is of synchronization, precision. Every light is a vibrational sight and sound. It is a rhythm and harmony with beams, rays of intensification and projection visibility. Music is light and darkness, precedent of vitality, stimulation extraordinary. It must not be forgotten that music is a language all its own, a language whose foundation and projection is melody, rhythm and harmony, the extension of consideration. Music is an advanced form, as in composition, sculpture, shape and form, arrangement, length, depth, width, message, meaning, impression, strength, degree, beauty, greediness, badness, all dimensions of being. Every place there is music. Chaos is music. Harmonious peace is music. Silence is music. There are different kinds of silences. In silence, there's a world of its own. In a lesser but not least important sense, silence is an integral part of all music. In a fractional sense, and judged metrically, we must not forget transportation. Transportation always results in change of color. Behold the vastness of the music.
Show started the third hour off with Ode to Burns, Bob Coley, and Sizzlin' Ted Lee. The Sketchy Side of Town from Manuel Armida and Orbut. Hope I pronounced that right. Sunburn Hand and Byron Coley. I think I know the drummer man, John, right? He played with Thirst for a while.
Oh, yeah.
Now
yeah.
He's a road boss for Jay Masks.
He is.
Okay. You want to finish up your thoughts?
The
second hour there. I'm sorry.
I mean, if you recall, I reviewed the first Minutemen single.
Absolutely.
Right? And I compared you. I said I thought there were similarities to the Urinals.
Yeah.
So it's like,
and
I mean, to me,
that huge impact on us. Huge impact on us.
But it's like, that to me makes sense. If you can say something like that, you're pointing people, like people who were at, this is what, 81, right? Or
right.
80, I don't know, whatever. People who were looking for punk singles, if they were reading punk single reviews, if you said something like the Urinals and people knew what the fuck you were talking about, that gave them like an idea of like what was going on there a little bit. It's like, oh, this doesn't sound like this other, you know, it's different. I mean, I just think that that's, you make a comparison, it should be sort of important, and it should give people some kind of an idea where to place something, you know?
Sure, that's, sure. You know, location, location, right? What about overseas? What do you think of The Wire or Mojo?
I mean, I wrote for Mojo for a while, and then they sort of stopped dealing with most American writers. It's, they're, you know, I mean, like, how many fucking times can you write about, like, a Sid Barrett session? It's like, it's kind of insane. I mean, there was one point, like, I offered them, like, I've got this 15,000 word, like, really good piece on This Heat, the English band.
Sure, sure.
And they were like, oh, we did something on This Heat. I was like, no, I talked to everybody who's still alive. I mean, I really have this, like, intense thing. They were like, I think we've sort of covered This Heat. Like, I don't even want to see it. And I was like, you know, I'm okay, but, like, it's just weird. Like, you know, when they first started, I thought they were sort of interesting. And then after about 20 issues, they started doing the same, like, basic issue every time.
And what about The Wire?
The Wire, I mean, I've been writing for it for a long time now. I've had my column for over 20 years.
That's right. But you also had a column in Spin.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, it's...
That didn't last 20 years.
That did not. My column Spin lasted about, I don't know. You know how the Spin column ended?
No, tell me.
Richard Gere, the guy from the... Sure. He was in the L.A. Reader and stuff like that. He was the editor then. And I was talking to him about my new column. And Bob Guccione, who has an English accent,
right,
like, came in on the line and goes like, hey, mate. I was like, what? What? Like, who is this? And he goes, oh, this is Bob. I was like, oh. And he goes like, you know what? I don't think the underground really exists. And I was like, what? And he's like, yeah, you know, I don't think it does. And then he hung up. And that was like it. It was like, oh, no more underground column. And it was like, this is about, you know, like 3 months before Nirvana hit. And it was like, yeah, okay. Yeah, whatever. I don't know what you really do in a situation like that. But, you know, he was like, no more underground column, no more underground sections.
So,
whatever.
So, you know, you don't really see validation in writing for some of these people. Right?
No, but it's like,
of course.
You know, I mean, it's nice. The thing that was really good about doing the Spin column was, I could write about, like, you got, I could write about anything I wanted to write about. And kids who got their, like, all their information from a Walgreen in southern Illinois could buy a copy of Spin magazine. And they could go in there and they could read about, oh, Richard Grossman, you know, Halo of Flies, like, you know, like whatever.
Richard Grossman, I first heard about him from Richard Meltzer.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I used to work with him, Ryan.
He had me do a gig in his honor after he passed away.
Yeah,
and taught me about improvisation.
God, no, Richard was a great guy.
Yeah, we owe Richard Meltzer so much. So much.
Yeah, we all do.
Look, he gave me this thing, some more magnificent pussies.
This
is Alpha.
Siphon out whole blood, turn around for a while.
kid with centrifuge.
Feeling this is not going to end well. greatest job I held during my days in SF was the gig I had at the McDonald's on Hank, right at the mouth of Golden Gate Park. I only had it for a couple of weeks, but I was glad when I first got it because I'd just gotten kicked out of the apartment where I was living because I had mistakenly pissed on a roommate's younger sister. She'd been on the road following the dead and she was sleeping in front of the fireplace, which you have to admit would be confused for a toilet if it was dark and you were very drunk. Anyway, I had taken up residence in a tree near the eastern end of the park, so it was quite a convenient job for me. The only problem was that it totally sucked. I was about the only person working there who was from the Philippines, and the manager, Manny, thought I was slow because I couldn't understand the training videos, which were a fucking tag-along in a similar tongue. But I didn't care that much since his evaluation meant I mostly got to stand around in the parking lot holding a broom, trying to make sure non-customers didn't take advantage of our parking lot's convenient location while visiting Golden Gate without a Big Mac in hand. This meant I could smoke at work, which was okay, but Manny was a fascist about drinking on the job. Even though drink and smoke are natural allies, he would have none of it, not even beer. Like I said, the job sucked, but at least it meant I could show employment, which meant I could get a room at this SRO on the corner of Cole and Stanion for $65 a month, which was an excellent bargain, since I could just make that much money selling plasma, which was a much better job than McDonald's, although it was fun to walk around to hate my uniform late at night, or to wear it to some punk show. Ain't life just full of choices? Stupid that I drank Mickey's Big Mouth malt liquor as my beverage of choice, when it was clear to every man jack of them that fortified wines such as Gallo White Port delivered a whole lot more punch per penny panhandle. My main gripe with their argument was I didn't like the way that sweet wine sat on my tongue. Mickey's tasted golden, sophisticated in comparison. I would tell my homies this when they sneered at my words. This shit will just get you just as hammered, I told them, but they were having none of it, declaring me a weak cocksucker, having done with it. But the truth of my statement was proven sooner rather than later. The building manager put up a notice on each door reminding us the exterminators were coming. They were going to be doing a big fumigation one Thursday morning, and we'd better have our asses clear of our rooms. This fact registered vaguely in my brain. But there was some good show happening the previous evening, and I staggered home on the late side. Maybe it was one of those nights where I was flat broke and had to walk back over the hills. Can't really remember. But I was white by the time I hit my bed. In those days, all I had in my room was a bare mattress with a large beach towel thrown over it. I could either sleep atop or beneath the towel, depending on weather. It must have been the summer since I slept on top of it that night and awoke coughing to find my room filled with white gas or something. Dead and dying cockroaches, which made me jump the hell out of bed, and also to remember the notice that had been posted earlier. I ran to the nearly closed window and threw it open. I drew a deep breath of fresh air, watching the white gas billowed out. Then I heard loud laughing and looked across the street. There were a bunch of my fellow residents sprawled around a bus stop, pointing at my window. I looked over and shrugged sheepishly. They were all obviously more capable than I was, despite their ragged-ass condition. One of them held what looked to be a bottle of Gallo White Port. He pointed to it, then drained the bottle's contents into his mouth, tossing it in the garbage can. He then pointed to his head and yelled, "Brain food!" Street from a laundromat used by blue-collar neighborhood types, as well as students from the UCSF Medical School, which was just up the hill. I was washing my meager wardrobe there one day when a fellow drunk from my building came in. He asked what I was doing when I told him my laundry. He said this was one of the stupidest things he had ever heard. He went on to explain that if you wanted clean clothes, all you had to do was wait until someone about your own size came in. Keep an eye on your load as they ship it in from wash to dryer. Then, when it's about ready, you just go through it and you take what you need. If you're feeling guilty, you just toss your own dirty clothes into their load, and you can walk out slightly damp, but a totally new set of duds. I was skeptical at first, but when I thought about it, I began to see the good sense of his approach. It would save not only time, but quarters and dimes as well. Money that could then be used for bargain bin singles at Aquarius, or the 75-cent breakfast special down in Valencia, or a 60-cent pack of Chesterfields. I can't remember the guy's name who told me this, but I owe him a debt of gratitude and perhaps even a fat Cuban cigar. But no one else is around and nothing fucking works. My room is up on the second floor and I jimmy the front door of the building open so I can survey the scene from the sidewalk. And really, it looks sort of doable. The first floor windows are covered with iron bars that curve out a little bit at the top and have spiked peaks, but not super sharp looking ones. And I'm thinking, I could make it up to the top of one of those. If I can make it, my guess is that the bottom lip of my windowsill is reachable, at least by fingertips. And I reckon that I can haul myself up if I can get a decent purchase on the ledge. With the window open, I should be able to slide right in. There are a couple sets of crossbars on the windows, and the first part of the ascent is actually pretty easy. I'm really glad the towel I'm wearing is a jumbo beach thing. Hopefully nobody will recognize it from their own purloined laundry. Anyway, I finally get a knee on the upper crossbar, and I slowly start working my hands up the building's stucco side, trying to pretend there's more to hang on to than there actually is. But I manage to keep myself pressed tight against the side of the wall, and I inch slowly upwards, hoping I will feel the bottom edge of the windowsill any goddamn second. I'm standing tiptoe on the upper crossbar, but I can't touch the sill yet, and I look up carefully and see I'm still about 4 inches short of my target. This means I'll have to rest my weight on the top of the spikes for a little bit. But I look at them closely, and it doesn't seem like they're sharp enough to easily pierce your skin, at least if you do it right. And my plan is to do it as right as any man in a similar position has ever done it. I snake my right foot slowly up to the top of the nearest spike and gingerly begin to shift some weight to it. It doesn't actually feel too bad, so I'm heartened. I start to move the weight of my left foot up to the spike as well, but as I do this, the bottom edge of the sill, even closer, I can feel my body beginning to peel away from the wall. As the sides of my ass begins to exert gravitational pull, I fall straight back, my hands raised in empty, clinging gestures. And as I sail towards the sidewalk, landing on my back, while the towel opens and flutters around me, providing a small cushion for my buttocks, but little other protection. Just then, the Njuna train stops, mere inches from where my head rests on the sidewalk. I am dazed, but not unconscious, so I just lie there as the folks get off the train and carefully step around me in my towel. Then I get up, wrap myself in the towel, and go upstairs before I kick the door in. I mean, what would Jesus do? I I decided to leave SF in the fall of 1979, although I did return in the new year. I have usually told my friends the reason I left was a guy I knew told me he'd get me a job washing dishes in Ketchum, Idaho, where I could also meet Mary L. Hemingway. But another part of the reason I left had to do with a bottle of red vermouth, a punk chick with a heavy 5 o'clock shadow, and a pair of hospital slippers. I will spare you the details until we meet again.
I haven't moved.
What for Pedro show last music for this edition. That's Magnificent Pussies with Alpha. Something live. Then Sam Locke Ward, Iowa City, featuring Matt Rebeleski. I have been pulped. Don't know that verb. Carl 2000 with Message from Carl. And finally, Hell Ride East. This was a very important gig for me because I was coming back from the sickness. It's a gig with Jay Maskus and Murph. L.A. Blues, our take on it. We did a whole, you know, I just got out of this sickness and from dying and shit, and I just wanted to do Stooges. So I asked Jay to ask Murph, and we did some of my gigs. And over here I did with Perk and Peter. We're still doing it. In fact, next week we're going to do one here in Pedro. But that was very important. So thank you for giving me that. It was great to hear that again. So yeah. Tell people about, enlighten them to Forced Exposure and Feeding Tube Records.
Well, you know, Feeding Tube Records is a label this guy Ted Lee sort of started about 15 years ago now. And there was a point, he's based out in Western Mass, and there was a point about 10 years ago, I guess, Thurston and I were trying to do a new record store. And so we started working with Ted because he wanted to do one too, and we sort of joined forces for a bit. And then Ted was interested in getting the label a little bit more geared up. So we would give him, if we didn't have to put the records out ourselves, we were more than happy to provide him ideas of records that would be good to do.
But before that, Forced Exposure, what was his name? He was a
Jimmy Johnson.
Jimmy, yeah. Good cat, yeah.
Well, Jimmy and I did, you know, Jimmy had done Forced Exposure as a hardcore fanzine that started in the...
That's right.
Like early 80s, when I was out in California still. And
I think you were writing for the Reader because you did a review of
What Makes a Man Start Fires.
You also did a review of us at the Antic Club where you said I had a bunch of D Boone had a bunch of bowling balls in his pocket, and then I had a bunch of hungry gophers or some shit in my pocket.
Yeah, I was doing all that stuff, and I had a column in the weekly.
That's where I remember meeting you. You were playing pool at the Antic Club.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I used to work at SST, too.
Right. Well, that's later. This is before that, even.
Yeah, but this is like 80, that's like 83 or 82. Right. I don't know. The first time I met you was that Black Flag show with you guys and, DOA and that version of...
Santa Monica Civic.
Yeah, Santa Monica Civic.
Right.
Rise up on stage. Right. You guys people were throwing all those coins at you?
Yeah, Biscuit and DOA, he didn't think... He says, "Oh, Minutemen's one of those demo bands, right? They got a drum machine." No, we got Georgie, man. We got no drum machine.
Right.
Those demo bands.
Yeah, man.
The sunlight was still coming in the windows. Meryl dressed up like Adam, man. That was a gig.
Yeah.
That's right. I met you. But I remember having a big, long rap with you at the Antic Club where the pool tables were. Yeah.
Well, no, we used to go there all the time. It was like, you know, but yeah, you know, it was like...
With you and Jimmy, you turned the fanzine into a label. Because ended up putting out a Minutemen 7-inch without, it's called the Georgia CP.
Right. Well, that was sort of I think you were like, oh, well, we could never do the thing with Meltzer, so I'll give you this and whatever else.
That's right.
But that was the thing that I did with, me and my wife really did with Jimmy. Once I was back in Boston in like 84. And, you know, it was a fanzine. We did it for a long time. And then, I mean, Jimmy still does it by himself as a distributor and stuff.
Right.
So he does all that stuff.
What about your, we're getting near the end of the show here. So what are your plans right now?
Just working on a bunch of writing stuff. Thurston and Mats Gustafsson and I just finished a free jazz book. And so that'll come out pretty soon.
Did you ever think of a bio?
Doing what?
Autobio?
No.
Okay. No memoir.
No, although my daughter's making me sort of write one for some stuff. I've been working on a novel for a long time off and on that Kim sort of like goaded me into working on. And, you know, whatever. I still do a lot of poetry stuff and, you know, it's different Jack stuff and whatever.
Is there a place on the internet that people can find you?
Not really.
Okay.
I got a Twitter feed. That's about it.
Is Dapper still going?
Well, we haven't done anything for a long time, but that was basically like me and Thurston and anybody in my family and anybody in his family and anybody else. We could conjure into it. It was good, you know, but we sort of ran out our thing. We originally were only going to do covers for tribute compilations. That was our idea.
That's a formula.
Yeah, we did Beefheart and Holy Modal Rounders and all this stuff like that. But that was enough.
Reinterpretations. Well, man, it's been a big honor to have you on the show. Truly.
Yeah, it was great.
You've been so kind to me all these years. And I love your writing, and you did develop a style of your own, and Richard should be proud.
Oh, well, thank you.
That's what I think.
All right, man.
Thank you. And you, I am still in the trenches with you, Brother Byron.
And you, sir.
Okay. People, it's been the August 14, 2021 edition of WAP. Pedro should keep your powder dry.